The Guardian. Football Weekly.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, crikey, it's the Carling Cup. Debut for Bebe with United, Spurs lose again to Young Boys, and a shock tomb win at Stamford Bridge. And above all, Mersey beats, with Everton stung by bees and Liverpool beaten at home by Northampton Town in the League Two strugglers' greatest ever result. We get the lowdown on this motley band of journeymen, has-beens and never-will-bees, and we hear about Northampton too. Elsewhere, there's news from the continent. Full midweek rounds in both Spain and Italy, where Roma's decline and fall continues apace. There's your post, and look forward to this weekend in the Premier League. West Ham Spurs, Liverpool Sunderland, Man City Chelsea, all that and more in today's Football Weekly Extra. Yes, who needs Commonwealth Games when you've got Carling Cup Games? Just like Delhi, they offer a dramatic collapse at the bridge, performances every bit as ruthless as that weightlifting hall, and plenty of big names not showing up, he said in topical intro metaphor. On board today, Gianpaolo Bandini.
Hello, James.
Sean Ingle.
Hi, James.
Michael Cox, who's only the man behind StatGeek Wet Dream ZonalMarking.com, the sort of place that I imagine Jonathan Wilson furtively opens a window to when nobody else is in the house. And the place, of course, that the go-to site for anybody who wants to sound like they know a little bit more about football than they do. Alan Shearer has never been there, for example, I imagine. Anyway, welcome to you, Michael. What an honour for you to for us to have you here.
It's an honour for me too. It's .net, by the way, I should correct you, rather than .com.
Oh, you see?
But there you go.
It's the kind of attention to detail that makes zonalmarking.com the website that... Yes. Anyway, and also here today, Martin Rose.
Hello, Jim. Hello
to you. We'll be getting on to him literally very, very shortly. Carling Cup. Liverpool play Cobblers. It kind of writes itself, doesn't it? This extraordinary result. Liverpool beaten at Anfield by a side 69 places below them. A side 17th in the fourth tier of the English game. Liverpool managing four shots in the 90 minutes before it went to extra time, and then penalties.
I think it was a shocking low, even for Liverpool. I think the piece by Dominic King, the Liverpool Echo, today sort of sums it all. It starts,
what's he say?
Pathetic, absolutely pathetic. The abomination of a story that is the modern day Liverpool Football Club has reached its most depressing low.
Shouldn't you have saved that for after Saturday's game with Sunderland?
Well, possibly, although you can still back Liverpool to beat Sunderland at a very short price. They're 1-2 on, so you'd have to put on £100 to win only 50 back, which, given the state at Liverpool at the moment, you wouldn't be rushing to do.
It's the Carling Cup. I mean, is this something that we should be taking seriously? Is it an indication of Liverpool's current malaise, or is it just that the Cup isn't such a big tournament for them?
Well, partly that, but I think it's also the fact that Liverpool haven't got that strength and depth. And Hodgson put out a side that he comfortably felt would knock aside a team, as you say, like Northampton.
All right, Martin's already weighing in here. I was going to bring you in as our trump card in a bit, but go on.
No, I just think from a Liverpool point of view, and I remember Sean and I had a conversation about this earlier. Why didn't he put some of his bigger names on the bench just as a security blanket? Why have virtually a bench of unknowns?
Well, because he was playing a team from the bottom end of League Two, I guess. I don't know.
But he knows the Carling Cup enough to know that.
Does he?
It's Roy Hodgson we're talking about. It's not as if it's Rafa Benitez coming in several years ago, losing against Burnley in the FA Cup, being accused of disrespecting it. You'd like to think that Roy Hodgson's got a bit of a better feel for, for English competitions than that. Joe Cole, why was he rested? Is he tired? How many games has he played?
What I think is going to be interesting over the next week or two is whether the press concentrate on the whole Hicks, Gillette financial angle, or whether they actually turn things towards Hodgson himself and say, he's clearly the tactic, some of the things he's done, play more long balls out of defence. You've had the comments about Daniel Agger, clearly not happy. Whether they'll actually
focus
more on that.
Yeah, what did he actually say to the Danish
Well, he was talking about how he prefers to play a more passing game, but Hodgson's strategy is to basically play quicker, more direct from the back.
Right.
And that wasn't really his game. But he also, that in fairness to him, said, well, that's the way he wants to play, and of course I will adapt to that.
Mm. Dirk, among the many, commenting that Hodgson's Liverpool team is playing worse football and getting even worse results than Rafa did with the same players, more or less the same players. Richard Whittle, our old friend of Villa Support Group, saying, Shawnee, any odds on Hodgson getting the sack there?
it's still quite long odds. You know, there's
but the story is beginning to circulate, though.
I think we need to be a little bit careful when we say the same players, because I'm sure that Hodgson would be quick to identify Mascherano just straight away as a player who was pretty important to Liverpool last season. Mm. But it is interesting with Hodgson. The Times, I think it was Tom Dart writing the Times, so they said the honeymoon is over. We're not talking about a divorce yet. But you know, the fact that that's even being said is pretty striking, given. I don't know, I felt like there was quite a lot of optimism behind Hodgson when he arrived. He seemed like the obviously correct choice to bring in at that point, someone who was capable of working with lower means and has coached at big clubs as well as coaching at smaller clubs, though. So he has that in his arsenal.
Although people would ask how well he's done at those big clubs. I must admit, a lot of that optimism there at the start of the season, I wondered how much that was born of people living to an extent in denial, wishing Hodgson to be a kind of cure-all for the enormous problems that Liverpool face, not least of which is the ongoing shenanigans with their ownership. And I think actually that is something that protects him from any discussion of him being fired, because there's no way the banks are going to get rid of the manager, and no way he's going to get changed, probably. Is this right? Until somebody comes in as a new owner?
I can't. I mean, I don't think Hodgson will go anytime soon. I think we should be quite clear on that.
All right.
I mean, I think you're right. It is interesting about the whole banks. It looks increasingly likely that RBS will take over Liverpool on October the 15th. According to Robert Peston today on the BBC, he says, as I understand it, lawyers are beavering away on behalf of RBS to investigate whether the bank can take control while avoiding administration. And of course, if they can't, then Liverpool would have a 9-point penalty, which would put them on minus four, yeah, which would be even a worse start to the season.
Relegation battle, do you think, Michael?
Perhaps. I mean, I think the fact they went out because they don't have any squad depth. Their reserves plainly aren't good enough. But in a way, I think that the fact that they went out is a good thing for their squad, because it means they don't have these games. It's a bit of a cliche to say that getting knocked out of the Carling Cup doesn't matter that much. But when you've got a squad as short as Liverpool's, and when you've got Gerrard and Torres, the best two players, they are injury prone, they do need to be rested. I don't really think they need these games. I can understand why the supporters are unhappy they went out, but in the long term, maybe they can put a bit more resources into the Europa League, which Hodgson had a lot of success in last season. Unquestionably, they should have beaten Northampton. Probably their third string should have beaten Northampton. But for players like Ngog, who I think probably will have to play a lot this season, especially, you know, Torres is bound to get injured sooner or later, maybe it's good that they're not, you know, going to second division teams and playing in fairly meaningless games when they might have a role to play in the Premiership.
Mm. Martin, you come hot off the train from Northampton. I understand there were quite exciting scenes at the railway station this morning.
Yeah, it's 6:30 this morning to see TV crews there trying to pick up sort of vox pops with commuters making their way down to London.
Right. Was there an atmosphere of euphoria among the town streets?
I would say at sort of 6:30 this morning, the streets were pretty deserted.
Right. The last revelers just making their way home.
Yeah, possibly not.
But it's a huge result, isn't it? I mean, also financially, without wishing to address, you know, off-the-field issues, but this is a club not in the rosiest of financial health at the moment.
No, well, I think when the draw was made, I think, and as the game was at Anfield, they obviously looked at it and thought, this is going to get us going for the season. We're not going to have to struggle through. I think there were only 22,000 people there yesterday. So given that they're now through to the next round, they get another away draw. It's just a bonus, really, isn't it? Mm.
Is this the most extraordinary result Northampton Town have ever had?
Well, I wasn't around in the 50s when they beat Arsenal in the FA Cup, which was a fair result, I think. Were you around?
Yeah, I very much so. No, thanks. But I was going to ask if that was when they did this extraordinary thing, when they became the fastest team ever to go from the bottom tier of English football to the top tier and then all the way back down again, all in the space of 9 years.
Just preceded, I think the Arsenal game was 58. They got to the first division in something like 65, 66.
Right.
And then they were back in the bottom division by 1970.
Like it was all a dream.
Yeah. I mean, the sort of euphoric rise was just equaled by the sort of damp drop right back down the divisions. You know, you talk about Northampton Football Club, that's what most people think about, the sort of rise in the 60s and the fall straight away. There's a decent enough appetite in Northampton for football. When they got to the playoff finals 2 years in succession in the 90s and took 40-odd thousand people to Wembley with them. So it's there, but people go and follow a team that are winning.
All right, well done to Northampton. While we're on the subject of Liverpool and this disastrous result, what about David Moyes and Everton, their defeat again on penalties at Brentford? Says here, Martin, you're an Everton fan. So a mixed week for you, really?
Well, yeah. I mean, oddly enough, I wasn't too surprised by Everton's defeat. It just goes along with following Everton, I think. I see Moyes has come in for quite a bit of stick in places, playing people out of position, which most people say, why do you keep playing Fellaini where you play Fellaini? You've got to sit and hold him in a holding midfield role, which before he got injured last season, he was outstanding. He's come back and now he's playing just off the striker again, which I think it just unbalances the team.
But didn't that work when they played United?
Not to an extent, because in the second half, he dropped a lot deeper.
They moved Arteta forward, didn't they?
Yeah. Arteta's going to make much more of an impact on the game the further forward he is, surely.
Yeah.
If you've got the blanket of Fellaini behind him and reasonable defenders behind him, you surely got to give Arteta a bit of licence to play football.
There was an interview in Gazetta this morning with Sir Alex Ferguson, of all people, and it was mostly fairly anodyne stuff, but one of the things he did say was that he was surprised that Everton weren't doing better this season. He actually said that he almost mentioned them in the same breath as the teams like Arsenal, Chelsea, and teams he thought were going to challenge the title this season.
A lot of people had them down as potential top four candidates, and who knows, they might go on a late season run like they did last year and probably the year before that and approach the European positions, but it is an extraordinary start they've had, and indeed, also with David Moyes, there's people beginning to question whether his time is up at Goodison Park, whether he's done all he can.
They've played well in games. You watched the United game, they played fairly well. The Aston Villa game, which probably should have won. Should they have given the manager some money to actually go out and get somebody that can score goals? That seems to be the issue.
They are traditional slow starters. 9 games they lost last season, 7 of them came before December, and the season before that, they lost 4 of their first 8. And only 5 in the rest of the season. So we maybe should give Moyes a bit of leeway on this one. But I think the key is, in previous seasons, they had excuses. They had the Lescott situation last season. They had injuries. There isn't a lot going wrong for them at the moment, aside from the fact that they don't have a forward. But
All right, well, we'll speak a little bit more about Everton and Liverpool later on when we're looking at the weekend's Premier League fixtures. Just to round up one or two other bits of midweek Carling Cup news... Is it a coincidence so many big sides went out, or is it just that, frankly, they can't be bothered with this?
I'll tell you what was a curious coincidence last night was that all the teams that scored first lost.
Bebe got a start in Man United's 5-2 win at Scunthorpe. Very exciting this, Sean. You saw it.
Well, I was only watching it on Sky, but he only played 15 minutes or so. But yes. His start was delayed because as he came on the pitch, a streaker charged on. Because normally they immediately pan away, but we actually saw 5 or 6 seconds of...
Male or female?
A male.
Right.
But then...
Completely naked?
Yeah, as far as I could tell, I wasn't sort of forensically examining whether he had a sort of small little loincloth.
Well, you can tell if he's naked or not.
He wasn't dangling his meat and two veg, sort of thrusting it.
Delicately put.
Doing pelvic thrusts in front of us. But
he was naked. All right.
But he was naked. And right. But they did cut to Mike Phelan and they were all joking away. But
yes.
Was Mike Phelan naked?
But Beebe was very impressive. In the 50 minutes he had, admittedly, the night of 5-1 up. And dominant, but he showed he was strong, he was quick, he was quite direct as well. He cut in from the left-hand side and hit a couple of shots. And early signs, but he looked quite good, I thought.
All right, Michael.
But Sir Alex Ferguson still hasn't seen him play.
That's right. Sir Alex still hasn't seen him play live. Yeah. Arsene Wenger, who once said, well, if you win the Carling Cup, can you say you won anything? Now takes the competition seriously. What about that then, eh?
Well, if you look at the odds, Arsenal have got a very low chance of winning the Champions League, about 7-8% towards bookies. They've got quite a low chance of winning the league, about 15-16%. Ditto the FA Cup. So it makes complete sense for Arsenal to actually go for it in the Carling Cup.
It would make complete sense for them to buy a goalkeeper as well, but they don't.
Fabianski.
Nick Greaves, let's not get carried away and forget that Fabianski was at fault and would by now have claimed the record for consecutive games being at fault for a conceded goal. Were such records kept?
He has to be doing something in training that we're not seeing. It has to be that every day on the training ground he makes fantastic stops and never lets a goal in. And just every time he steps out onto an actual football pitch, it goes wrong.
Mm.
It's incredible.
Are you excited, Paolo, as a gunner yourself, about the 4-1 win over Tottenham?
I don't know if excited is the right word. You always take some pleasure, of course, in beating your local rivals. And there was definitely some this week. I think it was the right decision to put out a team that was going to win this week because they've started the season well, and I think you can suffer dips in momentum from losing cup games. And I think about the other year when it was the FA Cup, but he fielded that weekend side against United and they got absolutely hammered, and after that the season just went off the rails.
Yeah.
And I do think that that's important. And actually, given that you've now got Chelsea out, you've got Manchester City out, you've got Tottenham out, this is now very much a trophy that Arsenal, even without fielding their stronger side, they might have to field a side sometimes like the one they fielded in midweek, which was a mix of older players and younger players, but they can win this competition. And actually, after this many years, Arsenal need to win something.
Yeah, and find the key to their trophy cabinet probably as well. I wonder where that would be. You mentioned Chelsea going out. What an extraordinary result that was. Well done, Newcastle, ending the Blues' run of home form there. Ancelotti barely mustering the enthusiasm to raise his eyebrow afterwards. He was more concerned about the injuries to Kalou and Benny Yoon. Other big results were certainly West Ham's first win of the season up at Sunderland. Might well be an important one for the Hammers. We'll be looking at their situation a little bit later on when we preview their weekend's clash with Spurs. Right now, though, that's it for part one.
Football Weekly Extra on guardian.co.uk.
Part two, Sid Lowe in Spain. Sid, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, James. How are you?
Great. I'm well, too. Did you find something to write about from that midweek round of games, Sid?
Yeah, I decided to, in the end, to write about Valencia and try and explain to some extent why it is that this team that should have collapsed with the sale of David Villa and David Silva is actually doing reasonably well. They're joint top of the table today with Real Madrid. And I think they're going to be okay. I think they can win the league, being their league, of course, because everyone's in a different league to Madrid and Barcelona. But I think the chances of Valencia finishing third again this season are reasonably good. I'm trying not to get too carried away because it's only four games and they haven't been brilliant yet, but they look like a decent, solid side who I think will be okay.
Oh, interesting. Real Madrid tied on 10 points with them at the top of the table. Barcelona 1 point behind with David Villa handling the scoring duties last night. There were one or two questions, though, about the strength of Barcelona's opponents. In fact, Neil Misha asking, was that a stare that we heard there in the background? A stare?
Yeah, she's decided it's time to play. She just bought me a ball to play with.
Oh, lovely. And anyway, there were some questions about the strength of the opponents last night after Sporting's manager decided to leave eight of his starters out. Neil Misha actually asking, has he been criticised in the Spanish press the way, say, Mick McCarthy was for his very understrength team at Manchester United last season?
It hasn't caused anything like as much of a stir as Nick McCarthy's decision to do it with Wolves has. But as you can probably imagine, so often, I'm sorry to say that, you know, I always seem to say this, but yes, it's caused a stir in the Madrid press, who are saying, isn't this unfair that everyone lies down for Barcelona? And they try so very, very hard against us. Mm. And they're a little bit annoyed about it, but no one in Barcelona talks about it. And in truth, it's been a relatively muted response in Madrid. I think there's a recognition of the realities. There's a recognition of the fact that this week is perhaps a special case because it's midweek games, which means obviously the games are coming in every two or three days rather than every week, which is the norm for a team like Sporting Gijón. And also Manuel Preciado, who's a brilliant coach in a sense of he's fantastically entertaining. He's got a great way with words. He likes a crafty cigarette on the bench, which is always good to see. He'll hide in the second row of the bench and kind of have a sneaky fag as if he was behind the bike shed at school. He said after the game, look, the thing is with Barcelona, you can watch all their games. You can study them as much as you like. I don't want to take, you know, credit away from Hercules, but theirs was a miracle. And he said, you have to study algebra to be able to beat this team.
Sid, did I hear you right? You said it's always good to see someone have a cheeky cigarette behind the dugout. You'll get the Guardianistas having a go at you for condoning passive smoking.
It's entertaining. Who wants boring, normal coaches on the bench? It's much more fun to see a coach having a cheeky fag, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Jose Mourinho is challenging him at the moment with his slightly bizarre chewing gum antics. I don't know if you've seen this, but no. Mourinho has taken to, before every game, he sits on the bench and he reaches into his pocket and he takes out three tools that he needs for the game, one of which is a pen, one of which is a little notebook, and the other is a packet of chewing gum. Now, it's one thing to take out a packet of chewing gum, and that's pretty normal, of course. Lots of managers chew. The difference is that Jose Mourinho takes the chewing gum packet and takes out all of the chewing gum and lines them up either on the bench or on the floor in front of him, piece by piece.
Wow.
So they're ready to eat one by one. Nowhere near as good as Javier Hueta, the old Deportivo boss, who used to have the same piece of chewing gum. Once caught dropping it, washed it with a water bottle, went into the press conference, stuck it under the table during the press conference, finished his press conference, took it off and put it back in his mouth and left. So that is the way to do it. I mean, at least Jose Mourinho eats 10 pieces during a game and probably gets some flavour. I can't imagine how long Irueta was on that same piece for.
That's quite a thought, isn't it? If anybody knows, do post in. David Wheater's chin says, is there a sense of inevitability about Messi's injury? The form he's been in, do you not think it's somewhat surprising that it's taken so long for someone to get at him like the way they did to Maradona when he was playing in Spain? What's the latest on Messi?
Well, the latest is that he was at the Camp Nou last night for the game in Sporting, but obviously sitting in the stands. We reckon he'll miss Leicester game at the weekend, away at Athletic Bilbao, that probably he'll be okay for next weekend. He may even, if things go very, very well, be okay for the Champions League game in midweek. So more or less, he's going to have missed basically a week or 10 days, two matches, which isn't too bad. Is it a surprise that it's taken this long for him to be got at like Maradona? These are very, very different times in Spain to when Maradona was done by Goycochea, in terms of the attitude towards refereeing, the severity with which referees deal with most bad challenges. It's a very, very different league to what it was then. I also think it's in the nature of the way that Messi plays. Of course, it invites challenges, but he's actually quite hard to hit a lot of the time. So it's not that much of a surprise. The other thing about Messi is I think he's tougher than people realise. And that's not to say that obviously just because you're tough, you can withstand someone absolutely walloping you. But he takes a lot of knocks and carries on.
Mm. One last thing, Sid. Sir Alex Ferguson eschewed the delights of the Carling Cup yesterday for a trip to Valencia to see the 1-1 draw with Atletico Madrid. Was he checking out Atletico goalkeeper De Gea? Or is it De Gea?
David De Gea. I don't know the answer to the first thing that I'm going to ask you, so you're going to have to tell me. Were Manchester United playing in the Carling Cup last night?
We.
So he ignored his own team's match to go to Valencia?
Yeah, at Scunthorpe.
Is that fair enough? I don't know.
I don't know. Anyway, I mean, at least his team turned up for it, unlike another cup competition not so long ago.
He was there last night. I suppose the obvious excuse is that he was there to see Valencia, who Manchester United face in midweek. But the Spanish media certainly are speculating that he would have been looking at David De Gea. I think it would be very good news for Manchester United fans if indeed he was, because De Gea is getting better and better. He's still only 19. He's already been likened to Van der Sar. I mean, I know to some extent that's because of the way he looks, because he's kind of tall and a bit gawky and blonde. But he is a very good goalkeeper indeed. And if Manchester United were to bid for him, I think it would be a very, very, very good bid. It depends, obviously, how much they can offer. But Ferguson was last night talking to García Pitarch, who's the sporting director at Atletico Madrid. So I imagine the chances are that his name came up. He was specifically there for that. I don't know, because, as I say, they are playing Valencia next week, which is a pretty good excuse anyway.
Brilliant, Sid. Nice one. Many thanks. Enjoy the weekend, and we look forward to speaking to you on Monday.
Brilliant. Speak to them.
Thanks, Sid. Sid Lowe in Spain. Paolo Bandini in the pod. Big midweek round of games in Italy, where among the big stories is Roma's continued crisis. A 2-1 defeat for Roma away to the surprising Brescia, but controversy surrounding this result.
All sorts of controversy surrounding this result, most obviously because there were some absolutely horrendous refereeing decisions. Brescia's second goal came from a penalty which stemmed from a challenge by Philippe Mexès outside the area that was clean. So, you know, two things wrong at once there. Roma had a couple of very strong penalty appeals turned down.
Oh, the handball. That was astonishing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as one referee pointed out on telly afterwards, this was the same referee who'd disallowed a Pato goal for Milan at Cesena back in the second week because supposedly the ball had touched his shoulder. But this time, this Finnish player throws his arms up in the air and the ball cannons off one of them, plain sight of everybody.
And that Pato goal was never. I mean, it was right off the top of his shoulder. But I mean, this is a real. I mean, obviously, it's Italy, and in Italy, we always talk about referees. You know, there was famously a board game chase the referee, which involved smacking referees on the head with mallets. Every
that
season
was marketed by Genoa's president.
Is that like whack a mole?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what it was. And indeed, marketed as James says, sold by a football club's president. So it is that country, and we always have these discussions. But this year, there have been some really, really bad decisions to start the season. First game of the season, Napoli. Actually, was it the first or the second? But certainly one of the first games of the season, Napoli-Fiorentina, there was a ghost goal, and it feels like it's just gone down from there. And this was a shocking one, and Claudio Ranieri was livid afterwards. Unfortunately, he seems to be going through a personal experience, something akin to Michael Douglas in Falling Down at the moment, which wasn't helped by the fact that Marcello Lippi is now being linked with his job, and he came out afterwards and said, I've got the quote in front of me somewhere, here you go, you make your own conclusions. Often the journalists know more about the situation than the coaches. Newspapers wrote the names and dates, so clearly they know about it too. So,
well, he made these wonderful veiled comments before the game where he said that some people like to sail in the shadows, but they don't always catch the right wave. And the fact is, Lippi's known for, you know, sailing around, which he did a lot of in the summer because no one would let him land after the World Cup disaster. But anyway, he's known as the sailing bloke. And then he made comments about, oh, you remember what happened in Turin? I haven't been just sitting around smoking cigars on the bench. So Ranieri, obviously very worried about Lippi. But Leonardo has also been mentioned in connection with the Roma's.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm still really struggling with this because this is a team that is up for sale. And you don't change your manager when you're up for sale, as well as which, if you're a manager, you don't take a job that's a club up for sale. for sale because you don't know if your job's going to stay there once someone else comes in.
Well, that's true, except that the bank, Unibanco, I think it
Unicredit.
Is? Unicredit. Oh, Unicredit, sorry. They do seem to be actually quite enjoying this business of running a football club. The directors keep coming out and saying, oh, we bought Borriello as a gift for the fans, the kind of thing that new presidents usually do. So it's almost like they're enjoying this hobby.
They may well be enjoying it, but I don't think they're planning on holding on to it. It's a club which has a lot of debt.
Regardless of the decisions and what's going on with the takeover of the club, has Ranieri not brought this on himself a little bit by basically changing the way the team plays completely since the back end of last season? I mean, last season they played with kind of Vucinic out left, Totti drifting into the centre, and it worked really well. They didn't have a permanent striker. Teams didn't know how to defend against them. And now he's changed it completely, brought in Borriello and Adriano. I don't think he wanted Adriano. And now they seem to be playing around a central striker and just completely lost what to do.
Well, I think the first thing to say is I don't think Ranieri especially wanted either of them. Ranieri wanted one player and one player only this summer, and he was a player who wasn't playing this weekend, which is Nicolas Bordiso, because he got himself sent off the other week. He'll be back for the weekend game against Inter. I actually think they changed their formation a few times last season. I think you have to bear in mind that Luca Toni was there at the end of last season, who is a classic front man. He did play in some very big games, like the win over Inter at the end of the year. They have played with a man up front. They do seem to become a bit flat. They do seem to have moved to a slightly flatter 4-4-2 this year, which is Ranieri was getting stick for, and that was part of the rant last week, was he was saying, look, you guys don't know anything about me. Look at the formations I've used, the teams I've won with, which he could just point back as recently as last season and prove that he hasn't always used 4-4-2. So that hasn't necessarily worked. I do think you've got a problem this season, and actually he didn't play last night. He was injured. But Francesco Totti has reached a point in his career where he really does not contribute for most of a game, and he's trying to fit Francesco Totti into this team, and Totti will do nothing for 75 minutes. He'll do something brilliant, like the weekend he hit the bar from 30 yards in an absolutely phenomenal moment of skill. But the rest of the game, nothing. And I actually think Borriello's a really smart signing. I think Borriello's played well when I've seen him. I think he holds the ball up well. I think he leads the line well. But you're carrying a player there.
Yeah, it's interesting. Somebody was saying on the message boards actually about that there should be a name for that moment in a great player's career when they actually go from being something you can build a team on to being a real burden around the necks of a side that's coming through.
And Totti last season was given this incredible new contract that goes for a decade, and half of it is a director rather than a player, but he's not going anywhere.
But that's the problem though, isn't it? Really? He's someone with such an influence off the pitch, while on it, he's waning. And I love Totti, as I've often said.
Stop, Sean.
I remember watching him in the flesh a few times, both in Italy and with Sid back in 99 when Roma drew 1-1 with Real Madrid, and wonderful off the ball movement. But he's past it now.
All right, well, Roma down in the bottom three, and as you say, they are facing into this weekend. So that's going to be absolutely huge game, particularly for the referee, whoever the lucky man is. Inter, of course, top of the table, just ahead of Chievo, Paolo.
Yeah, the flying donkeys are flying again. They had a really, actually, very impressive win last night against Napoli, and I know Napoli had played. It was their third game in a week after the Europa League and then playing at the weekend against Sampdoria. But Chievo went a goal down, and Napoli only lost twice at home all of last season. So to come from a goal down there was genuinely very impressive. And especially when you consider they've got the second lowest wage bill in the entire division. It's only 13 million euros, which is less than everyone except Cesena.
Yeah, indeed. Templeton the Rat says, I've enjoyed seeing all the unfancied teams do well in City. I like Chievo, Brescia and Cesena. Can any of these teams last the pace? Can we take any of them seriously as contenders for a Champions League position?
In short, Cesena, no. Chievo, no. I would say the same about Brescia, who are up there at the moment. I think they may do is challenge the Europa League places. I don't see any reason why these teams can't do what Bari and Parma did last season and overachieve, but I don't think you're going to be looking at them at the end of the season that high up.
Sean, you want to talk about Hernan Crespo?
Well, no, I was shocked. I was flicking through the various channels last night, and I actually saw him bundle home an equaliser for Parma last night, and I thought, is he still playing? And I looked up, and he's actually younger than I am, just about.
Is he 35?
35, yeah, born in July 1975. So he
came to Italy so young. Back in the heady days of that Parma team, he was terrific, wasn't he? Mm.
He never got the best of treatment in England, but
his scoring record for Chelsea was always really, very, very good.
He always came across as a decent chap. Did you find that in your meetings with him in Italy?
Oh, a decent chap, definitely. Yeah. Paolo?
I just want to say one more thing before we leave Italy, because I'm sure the time is coming near, which is just that Lazio this week unveiled the new novelty for Serie A, which is they have a live eagle, which they've flown in from Portugal. and it has a Portuguese trainer with it, which, because they are the Aquila, the Eagles, they're going to let him fly around the stadium before every game. It was kind of fun watching it, and some quite extreme reactions in the crowd as well. There's a lot of applause, some people were crying, very emotional scenes, given that it was just a bird flying
around
the
stadium. Fly, Eagle, fly, as the theme song says.
How long before someone takes it out with an air rifle?
Wow, that's a very good question.
The anti-vivisection league were up in arms about him, about this eagle being used all week. It was a protest. They lodged it with the mayor. Well, that's what I was thinking. They're not going to cut it open. They're just going to let it fly around the stadium.
Was it a composite bird produced with the sum of other eagles? I don't know. And to what extent is this going to be taken up by other Serie A clubs? Are we going to be seeing zebras on the loose in Turin? Most importantly, are Chievo going to be launching donkeys off the roof of their stadium?
I think that might be the point for the anti-vivisection league to get involved.
All right, then. Worrying news once again, then, from Italy. In Germany, the Bundesliga had another round of games. Mainz, the surprise table toppers, won their fifth of the five matches so far. Schalke finally won a game, thanks to Klaas-Jan Huntelaar. And McLaren won his second game in a row with Wolfsburg, thanks to two goals from Grafice. And Unka Unka posts in saying, regarding FC St. Pauli's logo, which we were discussing the other day, the skull and crossbones, he said, yes, it was indeed adopted by anarchist supporters in the 80s who came from the squatted houses on Hafenstrasse, the so-called black block. Actually, former St. Pauli goalkeeping legend Volker Ippig, a one-time development aid worker in Nicaragua, was a squatter there himself for a time. Skull and Crossbones also reminiscence to Klaus Störtebeker, or something like that, a medieval pirate who troubled the posh Hamburg merchants before being rather executed by them. And he says, by the way, I believe that Fabian Boll, the part-time professional and scorer of the opening goal on the weekend, isn't just any policeman, but even a detective inspector. Woof. Thank you, Unker. We'll be looking at one or two other of your messages right after this. Sean, what's trending on the message boards?
Well, lots of people are still asking about Barry, despite the fact
Where's Barry, Sean?
He's currently in Turkey. He said, all couldn't be better. Sun, sea, and enough cheap ale to sink a ship. It's what CP Barry, Scott would have wanted.
Ah, God bless, eh? Nice to see him having a well-earned break. And he'll be back when, Sean?
Early October.
Right. Porpenheimer, in other news, says he's out in Singapore. And, he was, this is a Leon Knight business. He says, he had some contact with Leon Knight recently, trying to get him out for a trial with a Thailandese team who were prepared to offer him decent wages and an apartment, etc. And he went to enormous expense and time and all sorts of ego massaging emails to sort everything out, only for Mr. Knight to email just before the flight took off saying, don't fancy it, bro, change my mind. So there you go, a little bit of perspective on that. Extraordinary Twitter business. Was extraordinary, wasn't it?
Do we think he got to the airport? Or do you think he just left?
Maybe he was going to, but Russian and Diamonds took his car back. And anyway, it's a very unfortunate business. Looking forward to hearing, getting to the bottom of that tale. James Heal wants to talk about USA. He says, it's Beckham versus Henry on Friday as the New York Red Bulls take on LA Galaxy, just like Man United versus Arsenal. Anyway, how about a preview? Well, the problem being that, of course, Thierry Henry got himself suspended, so he'll miss that match. The American media were warming up to describe it as a match 14 years in the making, but Henry suspended for, Sean Ingle, kicking a goalkeeper's kneecap while attempting to celebrate somebody else's goal.
That's actually what happened. Was he kicked the ball at the same time as the goalkeeper kicked the ball, and the goalkeeper's knee went gammy.
Ah, all right then.
I guess if we're on the subject of goalkeepers with injuries, it's something I was going to mention during this Serie A bit, which is it was quite remarkable scenes at the end of the Brescia-Roma game, because Giulio Sergio injured his ankle in a collision with Panagiotis Kone at the end, and because they'd used the substitutions, they were in injury time. He couldn't come off the pitch, but he was literally screaming and crying. There are pictures of him, and the footage of him are quite extraordinary. His face is really, really unpleasant, and it was, I think, quite a difficult scene for people at the stadium. Although people thought he might have broken his ankle, but it's since turned out they think he hasn't, but he's probably done some damage.
What was he going to do in that condition anyway?
Well, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking, surely you give one of your outfield players the gloves and just say, look, we'll deal with it on 10 men for a few minutes, because he didn't look like he was going to be able to make any sort of meaningful contribution. But
random sausage, my footballers who cannot really pull off a tattoo list. He says, if we remember, there is a precise taxonomy for footballers and tattoos. You have the hard men, i.e. Materazzi. Two, fashionista pretty boys like Bex, Cesc and the others. Three, nutters like Bellamy, etc. Not sure which category we're going to put Mexes in, because he's got a bit of ink. And four, nice lads who don't really suit them and are really trying too hard. Wayne Bridge, Exhibit A here, with Walcott and Landy Cakes Donovan providing excellent support. My new addition, says Random Sausage, is lovely like Matty Taylor, who's got some serious ink, but gives off a vibe he'd rather be helping his mum with the washing up. Not sure about Taylor. I think, you know, the ink sits well with him, but Walcott, I would definitely put in that category. Ned Potter, oh, you'll like this, is modern football's evolution, killing the number 10. Many of the best players ever have been number 10s, but could Baggio, Dalglish, Cantona, etc. thrive in the modern game with 4-5-1 and 4-3-3 so prevalent?
Well, it's something Jonathan Wilson's written a lot about in the latest 4-4-2. I think he's done a whole piece on the death of the playmaker, which was pretty much along those lines. I think we're starting to see it come back slightly. With the 4-2-3-1, a lot of teams at the World Cup were playing central playmakers. Schneider, Ozil, some of the best players in the tournament played in that position. Xavi did it, played a little bit deeper. But I think they generally seem to be either more versatile, or they tend to be deeper, or they tend to play higher up the pitch than someone like Rui Costa or Valeron or Riquelme did about 10 years ago. And I think part of that was the fact that the Makélélé role, so to speak, became so prevalent, and you did have players literally marked out of games, and so they did tend to drift to the wings like Messi or Ronaldo, or they tended to move deeper like Xavi.
So the rise of the defensive midfielder has meant that opposition teams now tend to look for players who can defend themselves rather better, or escape markers rather better, or they just basically move them out of the middle of the pitch so they don't have the attentions of the DM.
Well, I think 10 years ago the most creative player in most teams was central, someone like Rui Costa, someone like Zidane. With the 4-3-3, which has been popular, you've got Ronaldo, Messi, who can play central but often start out wide. And it might come full circle, because now you seem to see less players who are specifically like Makélélé, who are just tacklers. You look at someone like Michael Carrick, Sergio Busquets, they play deep. They're not really tacklers. They're more trying to intercept the ball, more trying to put pressure on players to force them out. And because they're maybe not so defensive, we might see the return of the playmaker.
Although for every Busquets, you have a Mascherano.
That is true. But I mean, how well is he going to fit in at Barcelona remains to be seen. I mean, Barcelona have started two games with Xavi, Iniesta and Busquets, I think. And the two games they've started without that trio, they've then gone back to it at half time after things not going so well. So it remains to be seen how well Mascherano can fit in.
Certainly does. All right, then on to the weekend's action and the Premier League fixtures. Now, normally we would just go to zonalmarking.net and crib down some opinions. Let's cut out the middle managers, throw some games at you, Michael, and kick back and relax while you tell us all about Man City-Chelsea. Chelsea have scored 21 goals in their opening five league games and conceded only one, as you're probably aware. This, though, I put it to you, Michael, is the first real test.
I think that's fair, and I think it's fair to point out that Manchester City did the double over Chelsea last season.
Woof.
And particularly at Stamford Bridge. I mean, the aftermath of that game was dominated by the Bridge and Terry not shaking hands thing, which was a bit of a shame because it was a really good tactical victory for Mancini. At a time when Chelsea were playing some wonderful football, they sat back, they sat deep, they hit them on the break. Tevez and Bellamy were fantastic. It's amazing to think that Bellamy was deemed surplus to requirements, because he absolutely tore Chelsea apart, as well as doing the same to Manchester United at Old Trafford.
I wouldn't exactly call it a wonderful tactical victory. For the first 45 minutes or full 40 minutes, weren't Chelsea completely and utterly dominant? And Man City looked dazed, confused and all over the place. It was one of those really weird games where one half goes one way, then suddenly something happens and everything changes.
Quite possibly, but I think it's a general tactic of Mancini's to sit back a little bit. I doubt he was inviting as many shots on target as he wanted in that game. And it was kind of similar, actually, to the Tottenham game at the start of this season, where for the first 15 minutes, Manchester City just got completely destroyed, but somehow was still 0-0, and then came into the game in the second half. They probably should have won that Tottenham game, actually, in the second half with a Wright Phillips chance.
Somehow being Joe Hart. Carlos Tevez has scored 24 goals in his last 28 Premier League matches for Manchester City. Everyone's got their hands up. Party hardy, Carlo Vandini.
I'll let Sean go first.
No, I was just going to say, if Chelsea did have a weakness last season, yes, it was perhaps against sort of teams between like fourth and eighth. I mean, they lost 2-1 at Spurs, they lost 2-1 at Man City, lost 2-1 at Villa, lost 2-1 at Everton. You know, teams that weren't afraid to sit off and sort of actually went for it at home. And it's hard to gauge Chelsea.
You'd
so
put
far
Inter in that category as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you kind of think, are Chelsea, you know, like a boxer who beats a bum of the month club contender? you know, like Joe Louis did in the sort of 30s and 40s. And then when, you know, you think when they play someone good, they won't be kind of battle hardened, or will, you know, sort of free scoring, you know, the way they're going to continue to go.
I'm going to come in on City rather than Chelsea. I mean, I think certainly with Chelsea last season. No, I think certainly you could say about Chelsea last season that they, by beating up on all those bums,
yes,
that, you know, if they do that again, they'll win the league again. That's all they need to do, is make sure they win all of those games, because they're so good at it. But the thing I was going to say about Manchester City was just that
they didn't just beat the bums though last year, did they? They also beat Manchester United home and away.
No, that's true. Yeah, I don't know if Arsenal counted as not a bums in the big games last season. I just want to say about Manchester City, I think it's interesting that last night they took such a relaxed attitude towards going out of the Carling Cup. Actually, Mancini, all of his previous clubs winning the cup early in Italy, you know, the Coppa Italia, which has become a bit more valued in recent years, but certainly wasn't before. That was always the first thing he won. He won it at Inter, he won it at Fiorentina, he won it at Lazio, and that gained him some approval, gained him some support. City, you know, they're not a team who are used to winning things. I don't see that it would have hurt them to win the Carling Cup. You saw with Mourinho when he arrived at Chelsea, he was all about winning the first trophy he could get his hands on, so that he had something to hold up and say, look, we're a club that wins things, that's what we do. And I think for a club that's coming from that position, that should have the amount of money it spent, a deep enough squad to be able to rotate without having to go, right, here's our first team and here's our second team for a game for a game like that. I think it really disappointed me that he took that attitude, although it didn't entirely surprise me, because I really don't think he's that good a manager.
It's interesting you mentioned the Coppa Italia victory, actually, because with Fiorentina, I was thinking back to that one in 2001, because Mancini's playing this system that basically has no permanent striker. I mean, Tevez is playing up there. But if you look at the positions he took up against Tottenham, for example, or indeed if you look at our chalkboards facility and see his passes, he plays extremely deep and links up other players. And it was kind of similar to the way he played when he first took over at Fiorentina in 2001. At the time, I remember that being categorised as an incredibly defensive performance, which I think you can still categorise Mancini's formations as. Mm. But in effect, because it had no permanent striker, it was maybe semi-revolutionary.
All right. Also on Saturday, Arsenal take on West Brom. Birmingham will fancy their chances at home to Wigan. Blackpool versus Blackburn is interesting because they've both got black in the name. Be interesting to see how that turns out.
Coherent. It's that kind of analysis, Jimbo, that makes
very different teams tactically, though. Isn't that ironic?
Well... they're actually both within the bottom three of the number of shots so far this season.
No, Blackpool?
Blackpool and Blackburn.
Really?
Yeah, and Wolves were also in the bottom three. And then Manchester City, fourth bottom.
Fulham, Everton. Everton's still in the actual bottom three of the actual Premier League table. It's Everton's poorest start to a season, in fact, since 1944-1945. But Fulham have got a bit of a problem, haven't they? Because not only are they without Zamora now, but also Dembele was taken out by that crunch from Andy Wilkinson. That was pretty unnecessary, as Mark Hughes was pointing out, because right at the end of the game that Stoke were winning 2-0 anyway.
Two sides struggling for strikers, similar situations, and both draw specialists as well. I think Hughes has drawn his last 12 out of 16 games as a manager, if you take in his Manchester City days, and Fulham have got 4 out of 5 draws so far as well.
Wow. Well, let's not watch that then. Liverpool-Sunderland.
I think Sunderland have the makings of a really interesting team this season. They're not good away from home, and that's a problem. But, you know, if they can find a way of working, and I don't think he'll do it in games like this probably. He'll probably use them as a pair more against teams that he thinks he can beat more easily. But it'll be really interesting to see Benton and Gyan on the pitch at the same time.
Is it Gyan or is it Jan?
I have no idea.
Anybody know?
I think it's Jan.
What do you think?
I'm not sure.
I think it's Jan.
I've been impressed by the right winger as well, El Mohammadi.
Oh, yeah. His aerial dominance really was the key to their last
victory,
wasn't it?
What column have you been reading, James?
No. just some chalkboards. All right, and what else? On Sunday, Bolton are taking on Man United. Hey, that's a test for United, isn't it? A stuttering Man United side. No, it's not. I think it might be. We'll check back on that one on Monday. Wolves are up against Aston Villa. Bit of a derby flavour then to Julier's Premier League debut. And Newcastle. So the reason I'm racing past these, and Newcastle will be interesting to see how they face that game after that rip-roaring success at Stamford Bridge. I fancy their chances for one. Not sure about you boys.
They're even money, it's sort of probably reasonable.
Enough of the odds. Right. For goodness sake, what do you think they're going to do on the pitch? Anyway, the reason I was racing past all of these is because I wanted to finish off, and, you know, time being tight and all that, by giving a bit of time to this interesting London derby between West Ham United and Tottenham Hotspur. Hammers finally got a win, didn't they? Away to Sunderland, for what that's worth, in the Carling Cup. And Abinna's continuing to look lively. Could this be the game that they finally get a win.
I think Tottenham are a better team than West Ham, and I think that's what will show. But West Ham will always be up for a game against Tottenham. It'll be a fiercely contested game because they normally are between those two, but I think Tottenham are a better team.
Well, Spurs won the fixture last season. Looking at their record, Spurs are actually pretty good away from home against teams ranked 10 to 20 if they won sort of 5 and drew 7. West Ham at home only won 2 and drew 4 against top 10 teams. Normally there are goals between the two, so that would be what I'd be looking at.
I think it's quite an important game for Tottenham, actually, after the midweek defeat. I mean, that was kind of taken as a bit of a nothingy game. But the attitude of the Tottenham players, admittedly, it was a reserve 11 at the end. And also the fact that they were playing to completely empty stands by the end of the pitch, I think makes it quite a demoralising victory. And I think they need to bounce back with another London derby performance.
And West Ham, when you look at their squad, they are better than their position at the bottom of the table. So if Grant does, begin to put them into a shape that actually allows them to express their potential, and the suggestion is with him using Aubameyang, that is beginning to happen or not?
I think that's true, I think up front. But you look at that, they conceded 13 goals in 5 games. I think you're right, people talk about Parker, people talk about Cole, people talk about some of the other names, but apart from the first half or so against Stoke, they haven't really played well at all.
Robert Green's been shocking.
Yeah, nice to him recapture his World Cup form. Yeah.
And Upson as well.
Hasn't been good either. Well, there you go. Well, that's West Ham Tottenham then, one of many exciting games that we'll be talking about in Monday's pod, Football Weekly. In the meantime, as this show comes to a close, it's many, many thanks to Michael Cox.
Thank you.
For joining us today and his excellent work on the chalkboards, which I imagine will be up again on Monday, will it?
It will be, yes.
Oh, fantastic. Sean Ingall.
Thanks, James.
And to you too, Paolo Bandini.
Cheers.
And to Martin Rose for joining us, before with all that exciting Northampton talk and the like. Producer Ian and you, the listener, many thanks. We'll be back after the weekend. Have a super one and we'll speak to you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.